Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good morning, Tennis Universe. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio to the UR Tennis Network. Coming at you on Thursday, the 28th of February, 2013. This is Bruce Lipka with today's show, The Bruce Lipka Show, where we are honored today to have as our guest the legendary Dick Gould. Now, folks, if you haven't listened to many of our shows before, you are in for a treat today. There is nobody I know of out there who has more knowledge and experience with this great game of tennis than Coach Gould. We're going to break for a quick commercial. When we come back, we're going to go live with Coach Gould. Our call-in number today, if you have any questions or would like to say anything, 714-583-6853. Stay with us for a minute while we jump to a commercial, and we're back with Coach Gould from Stanford.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. We're live today with you on the UR Tennis Network with Coach Gould. Coach, are you there with us?
I'm here, Bruce. Nice to be on the show. And first of all, congratulations to you for all the wonderful things you're doing. And I've had the pleasure of listening into some of the shows, and it's been absolutely a tremendous experience for me, and you do a great job with your interviews. So I feel fortunate to be here today.
Well, Coach, we're fortunate to have you, and like many out there, as a child, I only wanted to come to Stanford to play for you. Unfortunately, I wasn't good enough, but I'm not sure if that means that neither of us are very old, since I was wanting to play for you, or both of us are really old, since you're not coaching anymore. So
well,
I'm not really sure which angle, you know. I could read off all of your accomplishments, but that would take up my whole show, because they're absolutely magnificent in what you've done. But the one thing that I'd like to focus on are 17 team championships, which is remarkable. I can't get over that. That's an unbelievable statistic.
Well, we're very proud of that, but that wouldn't happen without just great players and great competitors. And it was a streak that we really worked hard to keep going. It finally slipped away from us toward the end, but we're very proud of that. It's hard enough to win one championship. Brian Bolland will certainly attest to that down in Virginia, what a great job he's done. But, boy, getting over that last hump, as Billy Martin finally did, Brian's right on the verge right now. That's really, really difficult. And when that happened here at Stanford, my guys came through in 1973. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Yep.
And then we won another one, kind of an upset in 74. And all of a sudden it just kind of snowballed. And you know, you don't do that without just great kids, kids who really want to get better. They're working in the summer to improve their games. They'll take coaching. They listen well. They're not afraid to express themselves, and they really want to keep a streak going. And I'm really proud of the longevity of our streak more than anything.
Well, take us back. Let's hit the rewind button and take us back to the beginning, to your introduction to tennis. And did you play as a kid? Did you grow up in California, and was tennis something that you did? Did you play when you were at Stanford, or did you just go to school there?
Well, I grew up on a farm in Southern California, and there wasn't much tennis in Ventura, where I'm from.
Okay.
My folks got my sister and brother and I involved in swimming lessons. There was a tennis court at the house we were taking them from. They weren't generally available to the public at that time, as swimming lessons are now. But there was a person teaching there, and they got the idea in their heads for some reason that I should take a tennis lesson. I fought them like crazy on that. I didn't want to be seen walking around in little white shorts in a town where you wore jeans. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, Rich, you either take that lesson or you're not going to ride your horse all summer. And I grew up on a horse, so that was a pretty clear-cut thing. I had to go through a lesson. And when I get there for that lesson a few minutes early, two gals who became good friends later on, I'm about 11 years old. The hormones aren't quite going yet, but these gals are 14. He's little hot pants and tight t-shirts, and I'm thinking as I'm watching them hit the ball that this lesson's really this sport's really got something. And then I got on the court very reluctantly, even at that, and the coach Harold Chaffee, whose daughter became one of the top players in the world, later married Ralph Kiner. He was a very dynamic coach, and he made every ball you hit an exciting experience. And it just you learn to love the feeling of the ball and the strings of the racket, and everything he did he equated with a sport. You step into the ball as Rocky Marciano steps into a punch. You watch the ball like Ralph Kiner watches it off his bat. This all of a sudden made me think that maybe tennis had something, and I from that moment on I couldn't put my racket down. Now, I was working all summers in the summer, so I never played junior tournaments in the summertime. And so I finally played enough in the spring, my last year in the juniors, to get a ranking somewhere in the top 20, 15, something like that, 18 in Southern California. And I was really proud of that because I just couldn't play in the summers and summer tournaments. And I came to Stanford. We had freshman teams in those days. You couldn't play in the varsity. I was number 5 of my freshman team, and we had a pretty good freshman team. And I moved up to varsity my first year. I was 7 on the team, then not playing. The next year I was going to be 7 again. That was on a team where we finished 2nd in the country. Jackie Douglas was our star. Davis Cupper to be. Jack Frost, another Davis Cupper, was here in my freshman year. And so I didn't want to sit at number 7 again. I knew I was going to be here 5 years getting my master's degree in education. So I figured out a way I could get into grad school without technically having graduated. The Dean of Students was a great help to me. And so I played again my senior year, and by the time I was in my 5th year getting my master's, I was playing at number 3 in the team, a solid number 3, and very proud of that, and really had evolved by that time just by hard work and being able to play. I still never played in the summers, but being able to play all year round with good competition, I took advantage of that and listened and learned and was very, very fortunate to play that high in a very good college team.
Well, Coach, this is what a small world it is. That, you know, we're all connected in 1 or 2 degrees of separation, I guess. But so the fellow who taught you to play Chaffee, whose daughter was married to Ralph Kiner, she's very good friends with one of my members, Annette Lerner, who lives out in Palm Springs a lot of the year. And I actually have had lunch with her on more than one occasion many years ago.
Oh, that's a small world. Nancy's
a
dynamo. I haven't
ago.
Seen her in a few years, but it was down at her place in Palm Springs when I saw her, too. And her dad was just a tremendous influence on me. I also had the good fortune of when that summer ended, I was entering junior high school, and we had a football and wrestling coach there who taught a tennis PE class, introductory class. And so in 7th grade, then I was taking a beginning PE class from this fellow, and in that class learning with me was a guy named Tom Shivington, who became my best friend and business partner in years to come. Tom being a great coach who won more championships than anyone in the history of California.
Yep.
State Community Colleges, and became Brad Gilbert's tour coach as well. And we remain best friends to this day. And then in high school, we both had a coach named Arnie Saul, who played number 1 or 2 at USC in some of the USC old heydays. And he was a very knowledgeable fellow as well. And my coach at Stanford, Bob Renker, was a great coach. So I had the opportunity to learn from a great beginning coach, a great high school coach, which is a little bit unusual, and an outstanding coach in college. So I soaked that up, learned as much as I could, listened as much as I could, and it was a great experience.
So you graduate from Stanford. You got a master's. You
No, I didn't graduate. I did not graduate from Stanford. I completed my 4 years but did not go through the formal graduation application because I was admitted to grad school without graduating so I could play my fifth year. So I'm in class of 59, but I got my master's in 60.
Okay, so technically,
I did not graduate.
Okay, so master's in hand. Off you go to Mountain View High School to teach, I assume?
Yes, I wanted to be a teacher and a coach, and Mountain View High School is a neighboring high school. I applied in three districts. There was an opening there, and I took that. I taught four-year high school. I taught social living, which was basically sex education, health education. It was a lot of fun. There wasn't a lot of structure to the course or course syllabuses, so I could do what I wanted. The kids at 14 years old were really fun to be around. I coached freshman football, which I thoroughly enjoyed. It taught me a lot about coaching. Coached the tennis team, taught driver ed, taught PE. It was just a great experience. And then I was there 2 years, and a neighborhood junior college opened up, a brand new school called Foothill College. And so I camped on the AD's doorstep until he was forced to hire me, and I was there for 4 years until my coach retired at Stanford.
Were you teaching still high school when you were coaching at Foothill, or were you teaching at Foothill?
No, I took a job teaching at high school and working summers at a tennis club and all full time in the summer and on weekends during the academic year. So I was a club pro for 6 years while I coached two years of high school, and then moved to the junior college 100% and coached tennis and taught PE classes at Foothill College for 4 years while I was also serving as a tennis pro.
Was it a big competition to replace your coach? Were a lot of fellows after the position, or were you the only guy?
My coach at Stanford?
Yeah.
Again, I camped on our AD's doorstep until he hired me. I don't think the job was ever opened up. He finally said, okay, Dick, we'll give you a shot. So it was a pretty big gamble for a guy who was only known locally, but I had developed a pretty good name and rapport with people in the area. I think probably some people stood up for me, and one thing led to another, and I couldn't wait because I really felt that although Stanford had never been out of the top 10 in the NCAA rankings since World War II, my coach came shortly thereafter, I really felt we weren't really touching the top. The only year, one of my years in school, the year I redshirted, we were second in the country, but that was because SC and UCLA weren't eligible because of NCAA rule violations. And so we were always pretty good, but we couldn't. In those days, there weren't a lot of good teams. You know, SC and UCLA and occasionally Trinity of Texas were on a bar way ahead of everyone else, and everyone else was just fighting out for a position behind them. And it was a moral victory if you played SC and UCLA and you won a point or a match or two. So things were very different then. But I really felt that Stanford area, the Stanford community around us was such that we really were a sleeping giant. It was something we could attain, and frankly, I was frustrated. It took me 7 years to win a championship.
Well, you take the job, you walk into your office in 1966 as the head men's coach, and retire from coaching, but you're still around there now, director of tennis. How is it different? What did the job look like back then compared to what it looks like now? Were you teaching
at Stanford,
or just the coach?
There were several changes. I was the coach of the freshman team because until 1972, freshmen could not play in the varsity. And we had a schedule of matches. I was also the coach of the junior varsity team, those people that weren't quite ready to be among the top 10 or 12 players on the varsity. So, and they also had a match schedule. So I was actually coaching, so to speak, or running practice, if you wish, for some 25 or 30 players every day, each with their own minor schedules and, in addition, with our varsity schedule. In those days, the schedule wasn't long. We didn't start any competitions until really February, and our dual match schedule was shorter. So it was a relatively easy thing to do. And, in fact, when school started hiring assistant coaches, it wasn't until probably, late 70s, I was reluctant to do it because we were winning the way it was, and yet I started to realize in terms of practice how helpful it would be to have myself or the assistant running a general practice and the other coach free to work with individual players, and it was something that just was too good to pass up. Our school asked me if I wanted to hire an assistant, whereas I was initially skeptical about doing such because we were successful. I finally jumped on it, and tried to figure out who would be the best one to hire, and a fellow I had recruited very hard to come to Stanford, John Whitlinger, was just off the tour and coaching and teaching at a pro in Cincinnati where he just loved it, his job, and I actually had to recruit him as a former NCAA singles, doubles, and team champion for Stanford, twice as hard to come here as a coach because he loved what he was doing so much, to become the head coach and follow me. So that started the assistance thing. John and I had to, we worked together for 17, 18 years, and I must say right now that a ton of my success was due to the support that John gave me and the excellent coaching and support he gave to his players.
What did recruiting look like back then? No internet, no, not a lot of internet, some international players, but, you know, what was the
well,
main?
Well, I remember the address. I remember the addresses of the players I used to write once a week from the time they're 14 years old on. I would drop a little note once a week to 810 Nina Street in Wisconsin, which is John's address as an example, and just say, John, how are you? Thinking about you. Hope all's well. And I'd send another one the next week and the next week. And I'd do this to 10 or 15 guys throughout the country every week. And once in a while I'd make a call. There weren't any real recruiting rules in those regards, in that regard in those days. So it was a whole different ball game. Then I started making some home visits. I was one of the few first tennis coaches, I think, to do that. And that was really effective for me. I think the thing that really got us started more than anything, because I was not known outside this area as a player or as a coach really, was the National Junior Davis Cup training camp. And that was a camp where all the top kids in the country came together for 2 weeks of intensive practice competition amongst themselves to try to make, quote, the national team. Once they made the national team, then they had their expenses paid to Wimbledon. In those days, you automatically, from the national team, played junior Wimbledon, junior French, and so on, and their summer expenses were all taken care of. So I hosted this camp for 3 years, 69, 70, 71, I believe, or 68, 69, 70, right in there, and every one of the top kids in the country came to this camp, batted heads for 2 weeks to make this team. Solomon, Dibbs, Mayer, Tanner, no one skipped. Everyone in those days played in their age group. They all played each other, and they would play two matches a day to make this team. And it gave them a chance to get to know the Stanford area for what it is. This is early June. I gave them a chance to get to know the Stanford area, gave them a chance to get to know me a little bit, and to realize this wasn't such a bad place. So then when I went out to make home visits, they knew me a little bit, and it really helped me. That was really what turned this around, and it was a tremendous thing. I'm sorry to see that go, because this head-to-head competition all summer long, these kids played in their age group all summer, and they got better because of it, and we had a wealth of players coming out of the United States in those days, largely because of the competitive system. No one ducked a tournament. Sometimes they stayed away from the clay courts, but everyone played all the tournaments together in their age group, and it was a tremendous way to improve your game.
Whose idea was the Junior Davis Cup? Yeah.
Well, it had been going on
idea?
A couple of years, but I said, well, why don't we host it out here at Stanford? I don't know where it had been hosted before that time. And it led right in from there. From 2 weeks here at Stanford, they went to San Jose, which is 20 miles south,
right,
and played in the
Burlingame.
California State Championships. Then they went the next week to Burlingame, 20 miles north of Stanford, and played the National Hard Courts. From there, they would either go home after being out here for 4 weeks in this immediate area, or they might play Pacific Coast Championship. They might skip the clay courts, but they play everything else throughout the summer and not duck. And it was just a tremendous thing. It was a pretty good deal for me because USTA paid these kids way out here. They paid for the cost, room, board, so there are no expenses to us. And we really did a good job with this experience. We had sliced oranges in the court every day. We had all John Philip Sous every morning playing when they came out to practice, American flags on every fence pole, vertical fence post every 10 feet. The place was really decorated up. We really, really put on a great show for them and made them feel very, very special. And they were embraced in the area. People would come in to watch the practice. We'd take them out to clubs to play some of their matches. It was a tremendous thing.
Well, as a junior who grew up in that year, I remember seeing a picture of Oskarski and some of those guys standing in front of maybe it was an old taxi cab or something somewhere at one of the events. Maybe they were in Kalamazoo or maybe it was the Western Open. Then I saw Larry Gottfried and Van Wanitzky with their Junior Davis Cup jackets. And, you know, the juniors in that era, we aspired to try to make the tryouts and to try to make that team and knew full well that the way you did that was to compete You had to compete in your section hard. You had to, everyone played all the tournaments in their age group. If you got invited out to Stanford, you had to play hard out there. It seems like that desire to compete might be missing in some of today's youth. Do you notice that at all?
I don't think the desire to compete is any less. I think the structure of the tournaments is such that kids are picking their tournaments based on ranking, and once they get that ranking, they tend to avoid it or go in the next age group and play up where they have nothing to lose. And I think that's really hurt American tennis.
Have you noticed less, more different development of games by players, or just they're just concerned with their results? And the second question would be, if they are concerned with the results, why? What is it that they're after? Because without the development, you can't...
Remember, in those days, there was no open tennis. That didn't start until 68, and it took a few years before it really took hold. So that was just getting started when we were hosting the Junior Davis Cup camp. So they weren't really thinking at that time too much about playing pros. They were just trying to get better and maybe play in the Davis Cup team sometime. And it wasn't until the early 70s when the money started being a little better and pro tennis became a possible and viable career. I think there was... There weren't tennis academies in those days, and I think that tennis academies certainly have their place, but I also feel that the local pro can do a great job in developing players. These players all came from different pros. There were some hotbeds, of course. They had Bill Price in the St. Louis area with Bobby McKinley and Chuck McKinley and others. Larry Parker, you had guys like Wilby Van Horn in Puerto Rico, who had Charlie Passerell, Stanley Passerell, the Ortizes, Tico Carrero, and so on, a big group of players from there. You had a few other pockets like that where there were some really great pros, as you have Robert Lansdorf today and some other ones as well. So, you know, the kids today have a big choice. Do they go away to an academy or do they stay at home? And you know, they're good pros where you are. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Sometimes kids feel they have to go away to get more competition, but in the old days, we get it from playing the tournaments, and the competition was there. I think today that there might be a little bit of overplaying going on. I hate to see kids in the court 5 hours a day when they're 15 years old. I think there's more to life than that, and I think that you take a fellow like John Isner, I think he kind of bears that out. You know, he went through 4 years of college. He has done a good job in the pro ranks. He's our highest-ranking American. He's continuing to improve. And he didn't play that much as a junior and didn't go to an academy. And whereas academies have their place, it's not the sole answer.
Well, it seems as if you bring up a really good point. As a college coach, before there were rules, for lack of a better way to say it, you know, there were more scholarships some years ago. There were no restrictions. Even when I started coaching in 88, there were no restrictions on the number of hours of week you could coach. What did your schedule look like for your players at Stanford? What did your practice week look like for the guys?
Well, I always believed in keeping the kids fresh, and I think that's one reason we did so well at the end of the year. They were fresh, they were ready, they weren't burned out with a ton of matches. We started practice at 2:30 each day, and we finished practice at 5 o'clock each day, period. That was it. We would never practice on a weekend unless it was the weekend before the NCAA championship. And I'd like to have two, maybe three matches a week from February on. I was not a big proponent of a lot of fall events because I thought that was a time where players could work on their game. And in fact, I didn't even accompany my first couple of players who went to the All-American tournament just because I kind of protested that concept. I thought it was too early. I thought the kids needed more of a break after playing all summer. So those rule changes, there didn't used to be any scholarship limitations. Then they put one at eight scholarships, and we did have eight players on full scholarship at that time, and we had unbelievable teams. We had guys like Gene Mayer, who became four in the world, who didn't start until his senior year and never played higher than four, which is probably a coaching area, probably was better than that. But we were very, very deep in those days, and the teams were mostly American. There were a few smaller schools that had some foreigners. USC had a kind of a pipeline, the Mexican Davis Cup team. But most of the players were Americans. And then they went out from college, and most of them went to college. They would go out and in about the way the ranking system was then, they could go out and play in the summer and they could attain a top 100 ranking like Tarango or like a Danny Goldie and come back to school in the fall ranked in the top 100, have those points for a year and go right into the main draw of Wimbledon. And play college tennis throughout the school year, maybe play a pro tournament or two. But it was a different world then. Now with the best of 14 or 18 or whatever it is, the players in the rankings are so protected that it takes you more than 3 or 4 months to get into the top 100. It probably takes a player coming out of college a year and a half to catch up with the guys who went pro right out of high school. When this guy leaves college, it takes about a year and a half or 2 years to work his way up the ranks now. It's just a slower process.
You know, was your concern as a coach when you'd go make a home visit and sit down with a player, was your concern or was your point of emphasis to them what you could do with them to play pro tennis someday? Or was it all about just, hey, we're going to come to Stanford and get a great education and we're going to play some tennis and, you know, where it goes, it goes?
Well, let me go back for a minute. We started practice at 2:30, ended at 5, and then we had about a 20-30-minute conditioning period. The rules that came in, we could practice no more than 4 days, 4 hours a day, including meetings and strength work, conditioning work. We never came close to that. We could practice 6 days a week. We usually practice 5. So we were fresh in the year and ready to go. As far as recruiting the kids go, the first sales job, of course, with Roscoe Tanner being the premier person, and a couple of kids before him who I just missed out on, was to come to Stanford and be the first to do something. We can do it here, but we need you to do it, and it's going to be exciting. It's going to be a long road, but we can get this done. And I just missed out on some guys like Zan Gary, as an example, Billy Colson. I really wanted here. He went to Princeton. Zan went to Rice. Dickie Stockton was actually here in high school, at Palo Alto High School, for Stanford didn't start school until almost October 1st. He was here in September to go to Palo Alto High School where he enrolled. Then he would walk across the street to practice at Stanford when the team got here, but the team wasn't here. His girlfriend was back home. He got cold feet. He went back home and ended up at Trinity. But the recruiting rules were a lot different, and these guys, I was very close to getting some of these guys a year or two earlier. Paul Gerken came here, who was a good junior with McKinley Stockton and Larry Gottfried, and was good friends of theirs. He was here. He didn't see anyone else coming in, so after 1 year, he transferred to Trinity. And I thought, oh, gosh, here's my first really good player. Stanley Passerell was here, another good player, but here's Paul Gerken, who's really dedicated and a really good player, and he decides to leave. Where am I now? And then at the last minute, Roscoe Tanner, who had signed a conference letter of intent to Tennessee, and that was not binding nationally, decided that he wasn't going to Tennessee, but he was going to come here, and that started us. Now, once he got here, he brought other kids because he was a big name and well-liked by all the players. And so as we started to get better in building this thing, we kept building each year. And first of all, we had a big base of young players, but then we started getting more of the top players from that base. And some of the players just kept improving and got better as well. So I was so disappointed because Roscoe, after the end of his junior year, decided to turn pro. And we had everyone coming back the next year, and I thought, geez, Roscoe, you came here to build this thing, and this is the only guy I ever tried to talk out of turning pro. I said, you know, we have a great chance to win it, first time ever at Stanford. He said, Coach, I thought about it. I just got to turn. I'm sorry. So he did turn pro, and then we won it anyway. Sandy Mayer came through big time at the end of the year and won the championship, and we won it as a team, and that was an incredible thrill. But then the idea was to keep this thing going from year to year. I think there are several things that have to happen, Bruce. You know, number one, they have to enjoy their experience academically, socially, and in terms of their tennis experience, practicing every day, their match schedule, and so on. And secondly, they have to get better while they're here. And thirdly, when they leave here, they have to do well in the world of tennis beyond college. And so if you put all those things together, and we did very well in those days on the pro tour and in school and so on, then kids want to go, start coming, wanting to come because, it gets a little easier to recruit because you have your reputation, the kids have joint experience, they've gotten better, and they're doing well on the tour. So those were really big things in terms of our longevity.
Well, Coach, we've got some callers who are lined up here, have a few questions, I think, and we've got some emails, but I got a break for a quick commercial. So stay with us here for about 60 seconds. We've got Nike Tennis Camp commercial, and then we'll be right back. Folks, if you have any questions, we've got Dick Gould with us today. Our call and number is 714-583-6853. We'll be back in 1 minute. Coach, stay with us.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At USSportCamps.com, you can plan out a Nike Tennis Camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit USSportCamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike Tennis Camp at www.USSportCamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike Tennis Camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. We are on the Bruce Lipka Show with our special guest today, Dick Gould, Director of Tennis at Stanford University. Coach, we've got a couple callers lined up, and I think you might know a few of them, so why don't we grab a call here real quick and see what's happening here. Coach Bayless, you on the line with us?
Yes, I am, Bruce.
My idol. Hey, Bobby, how are you?
Good, Dick. It's
boys, college tennis is going to miss you. And I'll tell you, I don't know, I don't think you guys are Nike tennis camps, but I loved hearing that ad at Nike camps. We had a great we have a great relationship with them. I'm finalizing my hiring right now, Bobby, for this next summer of camps. And it was nice to hear Jason Haynes with the ad because Jason, I had the opportunity to have Jason here and my staff. We worked together for a couple of years here at Stanford. What a great job he's done in the tennis world. And how are you, my friend? My soon-to-be retired friend?
I'm doing great, Dick. Yeah, I'm going to hang it up at the end of the season.
What a loss for college tennis.
You're very kind. As I told Bruce, you were the only coach in my experience that, you know, every time you play a Dick Gould team, not only do they beat you, but you can't even get mad at him afterwards because they don't make bad line calls and the coach is nice and you walk away totally frustrated. You can't even hate the guy.
Well, you know, that's
well,
a good point, Coach.
We had a lot of fun, Bobby.
Yeah, we did.
You know, Coach Bayless brings up a good point, and you giggle about it. And, you know, there are some coaches out there over the years who have done some remarkable jobs at building programs, but, you know, perhaps it's not true that after the match is over, people feel really good about the match. Coach, what was your philosophy that so much success yet never made an enemy?
Well, I don't know about that. I think it's so important that we as coaches we're role models. And you know, it's not a war. It's a freaking simple game, for crying out loud. No one's going to die. No one's going to be hurt. Obviously, you play to win. You practice to get better, and you practice to win. And that's the object of the American life. You want to succeed. And in a sport, it means winning a contest. But you're not always going to do that. And it's so important that as coaches we all have the responsibility, whether it's in college or as private coaches or whatever, to teach our kids to honor the game, respect the game, the fact that it is a game, and to respect their opponents. We don't hate Cal. We don't hate SC. If it weren't for them, we wouldn't get the competition to make us better. We should be thankful we have rivalries in junior tennis and in college tennis. And I think, yes, I absolutely enjoyed the young men I worked with, and 100%. On the other hand, I just enjoyed just as much my friendships with the coaches. We would go at it and battle like crazy and try to beat each other's heads out. But, you know, it was always done at a high level. I think when we walked off the court that we could shake hands. I look at Glenn Bassett at UCLA. We had a tremendous rivalry for a number of years when we finally caught up to them a little bit down there. And I think we just kind of epitomized class to our players. You know, we coached hard. We competed hard in our matches against them. Same thing with Manny Diaz, with Bobby Bayless, you know. But these are great people, and we can teach our kids so much by how we handle those situations, and that's just imperative we do that as a responsibility for coaching young people.
Well, I got a question for both of you. You know, one guy at a time, since Coach Bayless, we got you on the line here. Have there always been people who, you know, thought that winning and only winning was the object, or is that a new phenomenon with all the pressure of Sears Cup points and standings of athletic departments? winning seems like it might have in the college level. Seems like now it takes on a stronger emphasis, but I don't know if I have a proper perspective because I haven't been around that long. Is that an accurate statement or no? It's always been that way. Coach Bayless?
Bruce, I think it has gotten a little more intense in some ways because there now are many schools have financial incentives in your contract, and so you're playing, you're actually competing for money when you get to the NCAA tournament. And it changed a little bit when this Director's Cup thing started. It was the Sears Cup, and then it became the Director's Cup, and now I think the Capital One is now the sponsor of it. But I have seen a difference, and I think Dick would know maybe better than I, but I still feel like I'm pretty friendly with most people in coaching, and if I had to get a group of people together that I could have fun with, it might be a whole bunch of college tennis coaches because they're the only ones that know what we do.
Right. Coach Gould, you have comments about that?
Well, you know, I never thought much about the Director's Cup or Sears Cup. You know, I just wanted to do the best I could with my team. I never had an incentive in my contract, so that wasn't a factor. I can't speak to how it is nowadays. I just wanted to go out and do the best job I could and help make my kids as good as they could be, and I never really thought twice about it. So if that happened, great, but that was not my primary concern to contribute to the series of Director's Cup or whatever.
Right, from a developmental point of view, you know, for all of the junior players who are out there who are playing tennis today, is there something that you know, Coach Bayless said, you know, stepping down from coach, but Coach Gould, you see lots of guys come through campus and you have a lot of exposure. Is there something that the kids aren't developing as part of their game that they might need to? Do you see anything out there? Coach Gould?
You got it, Bobby?
Coach Gould, you take us first from California.
Yeah,
we'll go west to east on this
I think the serve and volley game is basically leftist. You see it on occasion. I think it could be used more very effectively. I don't think it's used enough, but I think the biggest single thing is that the kids are slow to finish points. I hate to see a guy starting the baseline in the first shot and by the second or third ball be 2 or 3 feet behind the baseline and finally 5 or 6 feet behind it. And then not being able to take advantage of the opportunity when the short ball presents itself. I think as a coach today, it's just so important to give the kids confidence in their net game and their transition game so that they are confident as they come in. I think of Andy Roddick as an example. Here's just a great player and big serve, big forehand. And, you know, he tried to work his way into net a little more, but once he got up there, he never really, really was comfortable up there. And I wonder what he could have done if he could have got in a little sooner, a little earlier in his career. Just another dimension to his game. And I just think that as coaches, we have a tremendous void. We have to do a better job of getting the kids to recognize and take advantage of opportunities to attack sooner.
Coach Bayless?
Yeah, Bruce, I agree with Dick. And we do specific drills, you know, serving to targets and anticipating a return here or return there and what to do with that ball and how to get to the net. It has definitely changed. Obviously, the pro game has changed that way as well. And I think people are just discouraged from coming in. I understand the rackets are lighter and stronger and the strings hold the ball longer and it's hard to tell the difference between a topspin lob and a passing shot. And I understand all of that stuff. But geometry hasn't changed and the court is 78 feet long and 27 feet wide. And when you get to the net in good position, it takes a pretty good shot to beat you. And so I do think that as college coaches, we can do a lot to speed this thing back to where it should be. I think the slice is underutilized today, and it used to be for a lot of players something of a weapon, and particularly with the grips you're seeing today, I think that should be more people with a good slice backhand that can get them out of trouble and actually create an opening for them.
Well, you know, here's something that I've seen going on, and I actually heard someone speak about it recently at the Southern Convention, about the new doubles, and the new doubles is you don't serve and volley anymore. And I watched a match last year on the Big Ten Network. It was, or maybe it was 2 years already. It was Ohio State and Illinois, and the server was back. The server's partner was back. Both returners were back, and it looked like they were playing a baseline game. And I was thinking that, you know, me and my old man doubles partner could at least get control of the net and probably have some success. Is this a wave, or is this a fad, or are there just pockets of guys who just don't believe in playing the net anymore as doubles at the college level? Coach Gould, do you see any of this out there when you watch matches?
Well, I first saw it in women's tennis, and I said, oh, my gosh, that's women's tennis. I'm not a sexist, so don't forgive me. But but if I saw four guys doing it, that's what I call it.
Well, it was so bad that
day. Forgive me, but that's that. But I'm serious. You look at the Bryans, and they're in every chance they get, and they're successful doing it. And you don't see so much the chip return, the coming behind the return, but at least they're still serving and volleying. I think the other thing that I really think is forgotten in doubles is the lob and the defensive lob in particular. And I think that it's a tremendous weapon. And I just hate to see, as I'm watching our college matches, kids who might stay back on a second serve or stay back on a return and just hit rally cross court or just hit at the net players on balls that they're taking on the baseline rather than from in the baseline. The lob may not win the point, but the lob opens up the court, and that's something that certainly is a forgotten art.
Coach Bayless, you run into a lot of backcourt doubles players these days?
Yeah, we see some. And what I think a lot of coaches are doing is you get a player who has an incomplete game. He's not a good volleyer, but he's a very good athlete. He's got a big serve. He's got a big forehand. And maybe in the ad court, if he's right-handed, you go into Australian formation, you put a man at the net, and they have to hit down the line as Dick said, you don't see the lob. Actually, the little bump lob over that net man in that formation is pretty darn effective. But
yes.
But nobody does that anymore. And, I always felt like in regular formation, you serve to my backhand in the deuce court, it's pretty easy to bump a little lob up into the alley over the other guy's backhand side. And even if he gets it in the air, it's a backhand and not an overhead, and we could come in on that ball. But if you get that player with, say, the dominant forehand, and you set up a formation where you have to hit it to his forehand, you get into an exchange there. It's short-term gain, long-term loss, I believe. I think that guy should be serving and volleying, and maybe you lose a few matches when he's a freshman, but when he's a senior, you might win the NCAAs. And everybody's too caught up into winning the match today and not thinking about long-term development.
100% agree.
I like that. I mean, since I got the both of you, I'm going to keep both of you. No one's leaving. With almost 100 years of experience here, you're both staying, so don't even try to leave. And
you got a Hall of Famer. You got a Hall of Famer on the other end of the line now. Bobby's going in this year, Intercollegiate Hall of Fame. So excited.
Coach, congratulations. I was aware that Paul Goldstein was going from you, Coach, but Coach Bayless, I wasn't aware. But congratulations. That's fantastic. Long overdue.
Must have been a slow year for inductees.
don't sell yourself short, Coach. You've done a tremendous job there, building something from nothing. But here's a question for you that I like to talk about a lot, and you guys both know Wayne Bryan, and Wayne and I go back and forth on this one. The role of the international player in college tennis, and I feel like the issue is not international versus American as much as professionals versus amateurs. But what do you know, Coach Gould? You coached all the way through an era where not a lot of international players Paul Costin getting to the finals of the NCAAs with a full team of international players just about, toward the end of your career, and everything in between that's going on out there today. What's the role of the international player, and should there be limits on it, in your opinion? Coach Gould?
Well, first of all, it's not so much different. Bobby, you think back 30 years ago when he published top 100 ranking college players at the end of the year, it listed the place they were from beside their name. And 30 years ago, 66% of the guys listed were from foreign countries. So there's not that much greater influence now than there was then, very honestly. In fact, it was really nice to see Craig Tidey come through and win the Nationals All-American teams. As Brian Boland's done a pretty good job of that. Most of the teams have been All-American down in Virginia. There are a couple other teams in the country who are very good right now with All-American teams. So it's not a thing of the past. On the other hand, we were all foreign at one time.
Right.
Our parents and ancestors all immigrated.
From somewhere. Yep.
And they, yeah, so we forget that, and our American way is that they have opportunity. And so many of these players, in all my years, I never saw a player bastardize the system. I never saw a player come in and fail to get a degree. And I don't know all the players, but I thought they were serious about school, and I thought that they were. I thought that they, and a lot of them stayed in the country and got citizenship. And a lot of the foreign coaches coaching today from foreign countries are citizens that went through the college ranks. In terms of money, I did object to a 22-year-old coming in as a freshman, having played 4 years on the tour and not quite making it, then going to college and competing against an 8-year-old freshman who's not even shaving. That rule has been adjusted, so it makes it much more difficult to do that, almost impossible to do that in the NCAAs now. And another thing that's happening in terms of prize money is that in August, there's a thing on the table right now with the NCAA that says that beginning in August, unless it's turned over at the end of July, overturned, and I don't think it will be, that in tennis only, that players will be able to play in college and keep all of their prize money.
Really?
While they're playing in college. And that's
so
been approved by
the
committee.
The summer?
Yep, that's right. So it's going to be very interesting to see if that rule holds up. If it does, then a college player truly has the best of all worlds. Right now, he can have a pro ranking and take his expenses, but I think the NCAA gave up trying to monitor what those expenses really were, and I think they just said, heck with it, let's just open it up. And so tennis has that on the table now, very likely to pass in the end of July and become rule for next year.
Coach Bayless, what do you feel about the international players and the whole professionalism issue?
Well, I agree with Dick on the professionalism issue. I think if you're a pro, you shouldn't be playing against college players. But I don't have a problem with the fact that anyone can come to an American college. The thing I sort of that sticks in my craw, if you're a basketball player and you want to go to France or one of those countries and play in one of the leagues there over in Europe, there's a quota on how many Americans there can be because that's our game. And they would never develop their players for their Olympic teams and so forth if all the roster spots were taken up with Americans. We don't have that here. We did actually vote in a quota of 50% scholarships needed to be, no more than 50% could go to foreign players, but we didn't enact it because we were advised by counsel at the USTA level that it wouldn't hold up, and if anyone sued, we would all be liable, and so none of us could. Anybody on the ITA board that was involved in passing that would be a defendant in a lawsuit. So we didn't do anything. We couldn't. But when it gets to the point where a lot of the better players in the country can't play college tennis because there are no spots, then I think it's a concern and we have to do something. And I don't know what the answer is, but the international players have made us better. And
no question.
The few that I've had on my team, Dick will remember Javier Taborga. We had a guy named Walter Delare that you'd remember, Bruce. And
sure.
They're great guys. They're terrific people and really enjoyed the experience, but we've never had more than one or two on our team, so I can't give you the. At one point, we had Luis Haddock and Javier on the team. Luis is from Puerto Rico, he's an American, but Spanish is the native language down there. I wouldn't let them speak Spanish to each other around the team because I didn't want that to be a divisive thing, and I explained it to them. I said, look, just when you're talking around your teammates, make sure you speak in English.
Bobby, you're in the NCAA Finals with an All-American team, and I'll tell you, my hat's off to you, and it can be done.
Well, if the goal were, if we speak more big picture and we're trying to help, I don't know if it's possible for the United States to regain, you know, the position it had, but certainly in tennis-wise of international power, meaning by definition the number of players in the top 100, perhaps being the country with the most players in the top 100, but certainly any relationship to having more players ranked high means we have more players playing down low, so there's a larger pool, and out of that pool perhaps, you know, as they say, if the base is wider, the pyramid can rise higher. So
I would say rather than start bitching about the foreigners' college tennis, maybe we ought to do a better job as coaches is bringing these players along so we have more competitive Americans to choose from.
Well, that's where I was going. I'm going there. I'm going to blame the coaches. Would it be fair at the college level to make a ranking cutoff? Hey, anyone ranked higher than 600 in the world shouldn't play, or would that affect American kids too?
I don't know. Yeah, sure it could. I don't think that would be. I would not support that.
And at the lower level, you know, as guys in college communities, is there a way, you know, the college coaches in my mind, from what I've seen over the years, are some of the best, most enthusiastic and passionate ambassadors of the sport, but they seem to be, you know, walled off from our juniors because of a plethora of rules. You know, it seems to me like if we could get the college guys, get the kids exposed to a little bit more of the college coaches who are knowledgeable, who are passionate, who are really committed to the sport, that might spur perhaps a possible groundswell, or am I looking at it through rose-colored glasses and it's not accurate?
I think it's sad. It's sad for the it's. I don't know how you could do it with liability rules and all this kind of thing, but it's really sad when you have a junior living next to your university who's a really good player, got a lot of talent, and he's the only junior around his age is any good, and he has no one to practice with. It's just too bad in a lot of ways that he can't take advantage of the college kids that are right next door and work out with them. But when you get into the liability issues and stuff, it's just not possible to do that. But I really feel badly because in that sense, college tennis could help these juniors.
Because that seems, you know, from a developmental point, you know, if you live in Paris, France, and you're a 17-year-old kid, you know, you're playing with the 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old guys who are trying to be pro players, and that's okay. But particularly in areas where there's not a huge population of elite players, if there's a college team, it's sort of built in. And I don't know if they can ever figure any way around that, but certainly that would be a wonderful thing, as you say.
Maybe this universal tennis rating system, if we give it an honest try, it might help solve part of that because it gives the younger kids a chance to play some older people, whether or not they be college kids. So that might be something we want to look at a little bit in our country and try it on for size and see how it works a little bit.
Well, rewinding to your comment a few minutes ago, I'm firmly in camp with you that the responsibility lies on the coaches to do a better job with the juniors and help them develop toward their potential, and then we'd have more Americans who are competing for top spots. But as you travel around and you talk to coaches, is there any advice you would give them on how to help their players reach their potential? Is there something they're not doing out there other than most guys completely ignoring the fact that you can go to the net? Is there anything else you see out there that the coaches need to be doing?
I think we have great coaches overall. And I think that, I mean, really, really good coaches. We know it varies some, but I think there's some really great coaches in the United States who are doing great jobs. And I think one of the big holes is that we have these kids spread out, and there's no center, so to speak, where they can drive for 30 minutes and every day find other kids their age who are near their age or other people who are as good as they are to play with. And they're all split up on their own little club, and it's too compartmentalized, and there's no one place where they can go. And if they win, they stay on the court. If they lose, they got to go back to the line and wait till another court opens up. This is how you get better, by competition. And I think we're quite meeting that criteria in the United States right now overall.
Would it be helpful?
Bruce,
yeah, Coach.
Yeah. A lot of the academies that are producing players, you know, if you're running an academy, first of all, it's a business and you've got to make money. And so, you know, as Dick said, I don't think you'll have that approach at an academy. If you win, you get to play more. And that's the way it's. That's in basketball. That was always the way it was. Your team wins, you stay on the court, and the next five guys come out and play you to a game of 11, and then you keep that up. And they're at the academies, there's such an emphasis on retaining the people. You've almost got to make the kids happy more than develop them as players.
Well, there's you know, as you call it, the basketball model. You know, I would love to see the USTA take all their money and not pay coaches a lot of money, but build centers and where you can walk up to a court and, you know, two guys play a 10-point match tiebreaker and the winner stays on. And, you know, indoor courts won't cost kids anything if it's a cold climate and there's a place they can go. And, you know, if we could figure out a way to make that happen, I think, you know, we put ourselves right back on top. But that's where, you know, having the college kids nearby, it's a shame. Well, the universal ranking system that, you know, you allude to, Coach Gould, for those listening, you know, similar to what we call the French system where, you know, we've got players of many ages in the same tournament. And that exposure, of course, you know, gives the 14-year-old kid who might not have a lot of local folks to play with his age, he could play in a tournament with the older kids. Coach, did your guys in the summertime, you know, both of you guys, did they go out and play futures and whatnot, or would they go out and play French, the French system? Where do they tend to play in the summers?
I had some kids go to France, and they loved it. And but most of them went up through the ranks of the lower-level pro tournaments. But the French system, the ones who went there, they weren't the kids that were looking for the points so much.
Right.
But they got a ton of matches in playing in that system, and they really enjoyed the experience, and they came back better for it. You lose on a Monday, you go to another tournament by train or bicycle a few miles away, and you pick it up on Tuesday. You just keep playing and playing and playing. I think it's really hurt that kids are moving out of their age groups too early and playing where they don't have anything to lose, and that really bothers me.
They need the pressure.
They need pressure against playing against their peers, and that's when American tennis was at its best.
Yeah, I agree with Dick. I think that you need to play above your level, and you also need to play below your level. You have to defend because that's harder competitively. It's a free pass when you have nothing to lose. You're playing out of your age group. But that system that David Howell has come up with, that I know Dave Fish at Harvard's been a big advocate of it, and I think it would really help our country. I think we'd gain. That way a local kid could play in the city tournament against a man, and they'd both have rankings or standings, as they're called, and you wouldn't have to travel to get meaningful competition.
Certainly worth a try.
It makes no sense to travel somewhere and play until you can meet everybody in your own backyard. And so I see these juniors there are plenty of men in this area who can you know, take a beating to a lot of our local 18-year-old kids. But off they go to play ITFs in different places, flying to get ITF points, and that makes no sense to me from a developmental point of view or a competitive point of view.
Yeah. You go ahead, Dick.
No, I'm fine.
Developmentally, the men, they'll see some slices or some odd grips or some different things that they're not going to see in juniors, and they'll have to learn how to fight out of that battle, and I really think that's helpful.
Well, I think the message today that I'm hearing from you guys that I agree with, and I think it would be great, is, you know, get the kids staying in their age group, competing against each other in the morning. Sure, it would be nice if we can get them all playing doubles again also. You know, if there are some doubles and some singles in the junior tournaments and they stayed local and everyone played each other, and, you know, maybe get the kids moving forward to the net at a younger age, you know, ultimately that might pay off as well.
No question. I think that's really imperative. We have a lot of work to do in that respect. You know, you watch TV and you see people slow to go to the net there and end the point, and so you become the same way. And I think some things might change that. I love this 10 and under concept. I'm a big proponent of it. The balls, when you're young, the ball's more down at your waist. It's not up over your head, so you're not backing up to hit every ball. And I think that we might see some really good things happen with this 10 and under tennis. I'm glad that we're giving it a try. And it's not going to happen if you suggest it. It's only going to happen if it's mandated. And it's a little tough for some people who can handle beyond that. But I think overall, we got to get behind and support it. I also am a little bit opposed to the open draws and things like Kalamazoo. I would love to see the United States divided into four regions, say, not related to section of the country, and based on a number of people, not USTA memberships, and have four qualifying areas where those kids would qualify to go to the Kalamazoo or whatever it might be. Another way to balance your thing out. So there are a lot of things going on right now in tennis. We're all working hard to try to find an answer to help get Americans back on the top. Whether there is a clear answer, I don't know, but it's nice to see us trying different things.
Well, I hope people are calling you guys because you've got a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge in this area, and I hope that folks are taking advantage of that. And, you know, I'm sure I've got a flood of emails here of folks who appreciated listening to you today, and I thank both of you guys for coming on here and spending some time with us.
Bobby, what a pleasure being on with you. And Bruce, thanks. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Coach.
See, there he goes, Bruce. He's doing it all over again. He's such a great guy.
Thanks, Coach. Appreciate it. I'll talk with you guys again soon. Y'all take care.
Thanks, Bruce.
Okay.
Thanks.
Folks, that's our show for today. We've had, we had Coach Gould on there, legend, Hall of Famer, joining us, partway through. Coach Bayless, final year working at Notre Dame this year, and Coach Bayless is going to retire. Hopefully you enjoyed your time with us today. A lot of good information out there. Hopefully you're getting out there and playing some tennis yourself, and we're all sharing our passion for the sport. Thanks for joining us. Make it a great day.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.